What's beautiful about this is the Eucharistic revival is about starting a fire, not a program.
A fire of love for Jesus Christ. The next phase of the Eucharistic revival kicks off, and it's focused on your parish. A warm welcome for the Prime Minister of India at the White House. But the visit is not without controversy after a rise in violence against religious minorities in the world's most populous country. Roe overturned. 1 year later, the pro-life battle has changed, but it's far from over. A look at the fight for life in two states that are political opposites.
It was called Dominic's.
Dominic's Pizzeria.
Yeah, and it was a hole in the wall. $500 down, but became the largest pizza chain in the world.
Thomas Monahan, the founder of Domino's Pizza, shares his journey from orphan to billionaire to the creator of a Catholic university and town. EWTN News In Depth starts now. Proclaiming the faith through Eucharistic processions. This was the scene at the National Basilica of the Immaculate Conception in Washington, D.C. on Corpus Christi, June 11th. It was one of many processions held around the world. Here in the United States, Eucharistic processions will likely become a tradition we will see a lot more of as the second phase of the National Eucharistic Revival officially launched on Corpus Christi. Welcome to EWTN News In Depth. The revival is a multi-year movement aimed to educate Catholics and non-Catholics on the Eucharist. The four phases include a year of diocesan revival, the year of the parish revival, which we're in right now, and a National Eucharistic Congress where 80,000 Catholics are expected to gather in Indianapolis for several days in July of next year, and then a year of going out on mission. On Monday, Pope Francis blessed the leaders of the National Eucharistic Revival, as well as the monstrants that will carry Jesus in the Eucharist during the five-day Congress in Indianapolis next summer. The four-foot-tall monstrants pays homage to the patroness of the National Eucharistic Revival, Our Lady of Guadalupe. Pope Francis expressed his gratitude to the members of the committee and the importance of the revival.
Al giorno di oggi, a volte...
Sadly, nowadays, there are those among the Catholic faithful who believe that the Eucharist is more a symbol than the reality of the Lord's presence and love. I hope, therefore, that the Eucharistic Congress will inspire Catholics in the country to recover a sense of wonder and awe for this great gift the Lord has given us.
The Holy Father went on to say that the Eucharist is God's response to the deepest hunger of the human heart. So what does this next phase of the revival mean for you at home? How can it impact your parish, and how can you take part? Reporter Mark Iron spoke with one of the coordinators of the National Eucharistic Revival to find out.
Eucharistic processions leading the way as a U.S. revival continues. On the Feast of Corpus Christi this month, Catholic parishes throughout America publicly venerated the Eucharist. And it marked the next step in a multi-year mission.
In a certain sense, it's the largest evangelization initiative collectively by the church in the United States ever.
It's the National Eucharistic Revival, a three-year initiative led by U.S. Catholic bishops to address a problem. Data collected by the Pew Research Center in 2019 suggested the majority of Catholics don't believe in a core teaching of the faith, belief in the real presence, that Jesus is truly and fully present in the Eucharist.
We assume everyone knows and everyone believes because this is what it means to be Catholic. And so many don't.
Executive Director of the National Eucharistic Congress, Tim Glimkowski, spoke to us as 1 year of the diocesan phase to introduce the revival wrapped up, and the second year focused on individual parishes begins.
This second phase of the Eucharistic revival invites all Catholic parishes across the entire country to get even more involved, to renew belief and devotion, to keep Christ at the heart of each parish by inspiring greater love for the Eucharist.
Glimkowski describes it as a critical point, the most important phase of the revival.
Those Catholics in the pews, some of whom are engaged and don't believe in the real presence of Jesus in the Eucharist, some who are not engaged, are really going to be invited into that deeper encounter and relationship themselves.
Glimkowski invites Catholics to the National Eucharistic Revival website for ideas and resources on how to spark revival at their own parish. Revival leader Bishop Andrew Cousins hopes parishes will form Eucharistic-focused small groups during the parish year and invite people who may be struggling with faith.
If they get in a small group with other people who have real faith, and then we give them some really good formation through our online, you know, platforms, and then there's small group faith sharing, this can actually be a place where there's real conversions that take place.
Bishop Cousins says Eucharistic adoration on the parish level can also lead to conversions of hearts and minds.
A parish that takes adoration seriously, you find the whole Eucharistic life of the parish grows. More people start coming to Mass, right? And deeper prayer lives, deeper conversions, because whenever we honor Christ in the Eucharist, it brings great spiritual benefit to us.
At the conclusion of the parish year next summer, a National Eucharistic Congress in Indianapolis will take place, and Catholics around the country are invited to join one of four pilgrimage routes to Indianapolis in 2024. But for now, the focus is on individual Catholic parishes, the people worshiping inside, and those who have yet to be invited in. The Eucharist is at the heart of each Catholic Mass, and all Catholics are called to a renewed understanding and deeper appreciation for our communal worship.
It means also for priests, like, how do I celebrate the Mass? How do I prepare for Mass? Even for lay people, how do I understand the Mass? Do I know really what the Mass is about? And do I understand the sacrifice of the Mass and how that's supposed to transform my life? And
the hope is that this Eucharistic revival will have a long-lasting impact. Glimkowski says it's time for the laity to reclaim their faith and start living it.
Right now is a moment for a heroic laity that is willing to risk for the sake of the gospel in our daily lives, in our ordinary lives, in small ways that'll never be seen, and in big ways for God. And so I think this Eucharistic revival is a perfect time for us to risk it all on God again and say, I place my entire trust in you.
Mark Irons, EWTN News in Depth.
And we're joined now by Father Craig Vasek, an instrumental member of the Eucharistic Revival, who was at the Vatican on Monday to meet with the Pope. It's so great to have you here. We just watched Mark's piece describing this second phase of the revival, but what are your hopes for it?
Yeah, for the second phase of the revival of the parish year, we hope that what we've been doing for the last year during the diocesan phase is now implemented at every parish throughout the country, 17,000 parishes, that they would lift the Lord Jesus high, that they would celebrate the Eucharist as the highest form of our Catholic life together, that we would love him, that we would know how to love him there, and that we would pay every homage and worthy adoration to him in his Eucharistic presence.
Yes, I know that's something that Bishop Cousins mentioned, this idea of having these parish focus groups. Well, we have video of you carrying the monstrance up through the Vatican to the Holy Father. Tell us, who made this monstrance and what symbolism does it have?
Yeah, so this was a very special treat for me personally because I was the one tasked with finding the monstrance as well as the chalice and paten that we had blessed. And so it was a great delight for me to be able to carry or at least half of the monstrance into the presence of the Holy Father. He loved it. He commented a couple different times, "E grande, e bello," with a big smile on his face, you know, so he really enjoyed it. We had it made following Archbishop Gomez, who had a beautiful monstrance made in Los Angeles. We followed a lead there and then another lead from another angle, but they both led to Mexico, to Guadalupe, to Our Lady of Guadalupe. Mm. And so we were able to have it custom made, an excellent example of high quality metal, 4 feet tall, something like 35 pounds, but it would hold like a 10 or 11 inch host so that masses of people, I mean, we're talking 70, 80,000 people at the Congress, will be able to gaze upon the Lord together.
Well, you talk about carrying the top. Someone else had to carry the bottom. It was, you know, complicated in terms of the way that it's formed, but also how heavy it is. Well, tell us, how can lay people then participate in this phase? How would you encourage them to get involved?
There are so many ways. So obviously through the parish, which is where the revival, we hope, takes main anchor. But also we have a great website, EucharisticRevival.org, EucharisticPilgrimage.org, EucharisticCongress.org. All three of those have been unveiled in a higher caliber way just recently because there's so many things developing and unfolding as we go. So people can go to those websites to see everything. But just to say a few things, we're hoping that more people would invite people back back to the celebration of Holy Mass, obviously the source and summit of our Christian life, that parishes would explore ways of loving Jesus in the Eucharist, of serving him in the poor. So the Holy Father encouraged us, after we encountered the Lord, to go out to the infirm and to the elderly. And we had on our itinerary in Rome to exactly do that. We went to the Missionaries of Charity to spend time with them at their homeless shelter to learn more of what Mother Teresa used to say, which is we have to be able to see and love Jesus in the Eucharist, hidden in the Eucharist, so that we can see him and love him hidden in the poor. And so we were so delighted that he commented on that, keyed in on that, because it's exactly what we are about.
Father Vasek, real quick, you're a Eucharistic preacher. What does that mean?
Yeah, a Eucharistic preacher, it turns out, means that we proclaim the death and resurrection of our Lord Jesus Christ for the forgiveness of sins, so that we can learn how to love him in response to his loving initiative towards us, and to be able to locate that love in his Eucharistic gift through the Holy Mass and in adoration of his loving Eucharistic gift for us.
Well, I know that there are different places where you're preaching. It's available online as well, and we're looking forward to sharing in that revival with you and the love of our Lord. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Monsi.
Still to come on EWTN News In Depth, the one-year anniversary of Roe being overturned, how the pro-life movement has changed course, and the new challenges it faces.
There are many issues on which we profoundly, even vehemently, disagree.
One of the most consequential relationships between countries, U.S.-China ties, the efforts to ease tensions amid growing security concerns. Plus, despite allegations of human rights violations in India, President Biden hosts a state dinner for their prime minister. Expert analysis next.
The first high-level U.S. visit to China in 5 years amid deteriorating relations. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken met with Chinese President Xi Jinping on Monday in hopes of repairing strained ties and strengthening communication between the two countries. The superpowers agreed to stabilize relations, but China has refused to revitalize military-to-military communication, which was Blinken's biggest ask. Bilateral ties have become strained in the wake of the Chinese spy balloon incident. Tensions around Taiwan, where the two countries hold military exercises, China's support for Russia amid the ongoing invasion of Ukraine, protection of U.S. technology, which has led to sanctions, and most recently, a report by the Wall Street Journal that Beijing would establish a military training facility in Cuba.
I made clear that we'll continue to take targeted actions that are necessary to protect U.S. national security. I also specifically raised wrongfully detained U.S. citizens and those facing exit bans.
Blinken also raised concerns about human rights violations throughout China and in Hong Kong by the Chinese Communist Party. India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi is also facing accusations of human rights violations. And now some critics are claiming President Joe Biden is turning a blind eye to violations in India, as the White House hosted a state dinner for the Prime Minister on Thursday. Modi was welcomed with cheers at the White House, with protesters just outside. The Prime Minister is accused of introducing divisive policies that discriminate against Muslims and other minorities, including Christians. Despite the allegations of religious, political, and press freedoms backsliding, Biden and Modi mostly skirted the controversial issues to announce new trade deals. In an address to Congress, Modi was met with several cheers from lawmakers and even standing ovations.
We are home to all faiths in the world, and we celebrate all of them.
Prime Minister Modi mentioned several times throughout his visit the importance of democracy in India. But while many in Congress applauded, there are some human rights and religious freedom concerns that other members of Congress have raised. EWTN's Eric Rosales spoke with Representative Chris Smith just before Modi's visit.
Unfortunately, Prime Minister Modi has been directly responsible in the past, and present for religious persecution. I mean, India is a great nation, but unfortunately its policies are very, very antithetical to Christians, in terms of their positions, and others. Muslims and others also don't fare very well either. So, in terms of religious persecution, it is very real, and he and his government are not doing enough to stop it.
We have with us Knox Thames, former U.S. State Department envoy for religious minorities in the Middle East and South Asia, and a fellow at Pepperdine University. He joins us now to talk about the implications of Modi's visit. Knox, it's great to have you here. Let's dive into these allegations of human rights and religious liberty violations. What groups are victims to this in India today?
Well, the two foremost groups who are face consistent victimization are Christians and Muslims. I think when the Prime Minister said before Congress that they welcome and celebrate all religious communities in India, those two faith groups would be surprised to hear that. There are consistent instances of lynchings of Muslims for allegations of selling or killing cows. Churches are closed. And right now we've got some of the worst violence against Christians in the far eastern state of Manipur happening, where over 300 churches have been torched. It's up to Prime Minister Modi and his party and his supporters to go back to India's secular roots that defends human rights and religious freedoms for all Indians, regardless of what they believe.
Now, Knox, the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom has urged President Biden to address these religious freedom and other human rights concerns with the Prime Minister, but that, of course, hasn't happened, at least not in public. What do you say to this?
Well, I was pleased to see USERF speaking out. Also, 75 members of President Biden's own party, 75 Democrats from the House and Senate, wrote him urging him to raise these issues. We did see him talk about human rights. He specifically mentioned religious freedom in India during the press conference. But I think the bigger question is, why are we lavishing such praise on Prime Minister Modi, a person who's leading India away from its shared democratic values, away from respect for minorities? I question the level of attention Mr. Modi received. And I also say, just to be fair, this is a bipartisan problem. When President Trump visited India, he ignored riots that victimized Muslims. He refused to designate India as a CPC, a country of particular concern. So there's a strain of thought here in Washington amongst high-level policymakers that we have to pull India towards us and away from China. But if the India that we're drawing nearer towards doesn't respect human rights, doesn't respect religious freedom, then we're really not finding a new ally. We're creating a new problem.
Now, Knox, there seem to be some dissonance between the great welcome that he received and the talking points from President Biden and what Secretary Blinken was doing. Can you explain a little bit of those differences? And maybe there's just a lack of communication with the administration.
Well, it's certainly a complicated country. I mean, it's 1.4 billion people. If it was placed over the continental United States, it would cover a third of our country. It's a big, complicated place. It is, in theory, a great partner for us to counter authoritarian China. But we've got to take our values into these conversations. And friends don't let friends commit human rights abuses. So we've got so much in common with India: democratic values, multi-ethnic, multi-cultural, multi-religious countries. But when we see a friend turning away from those, we need to speak publicly and forcefully about that and create conditions, create consequences when Mr. Modi chooses to go a different direction. I haven't seen consequences laid on him by either party in the last 10 years, and he's smart enough to realize that, and he's going to continue to take these gifts and pursue his hard right Hindu agenda until there's a stronger force pushing back.
Well, there's definitely a stronger force or additional player in that China is a big factor here. What do you say to those who observe that the U.S. is in this delicate tap dance with China over relations with India? If the U.S. goes in too hard or publicly on India about human rights violations, then they worry that they will push India closer to making long-term ties with that U.S. rival, China. Tell us a little more about that.
Yeah, well, I question the sort of basic supposition of that. Look, China sits on India's border. China has hundreds of thousands of troops on India's border. China has tried to seize Indian land. They're forming alliances with India's neighbors. They're trying to surround India. India should be coming to us, asking us to help. We don't need to be. I question this need for us to try to woo India when we're the country that can be the best counterbalance for them against an encroaching China. We've got great allies in the region with Australia, New Zealand, Japan, South Korea. India is a nice to have. I don't think it's a must have, but we're treating it like it is. And I think Prime Minister Modi, he's a savvy politician. He's getting a lot of gifts and presents at very little cost to his own agenda.
Is it just because the financial incentives are so much more lucrative than the reality of fighting for human rights?
Well, there's always the issue of military to military engagement and commercial ties. While the United States, I think, traditionally across the administrations and party has always been a leader on human rights. Mm-hmm. Because we've got so many other interests, we're always balancing and juggling. And sadly, human rights often falls down the list. And this is where your listeners, your viewers can play an important role to let their members of Congress know that we expect America to be a force for liberty, a force for freedom, a force for human rights for everybody, especially with our friends, a country like India.
Well, Knox, we're grateful for your analysis and the call to action, and we are grateful, too, that you continue to shape the next generation on these important issues. Great to have you.
Thank you.
When God is insulted, when the beliefs of any of our neighbors are ridiculed, it diminishes all of us.
Strong words from Archbishop Gomez in the wake of honors given to an anti-Catholic group. More on how he and lay Catholics responded. Plus,
gracias, señora.
The focus on Latin America as Pope Francis meets with some heads of state. What the Vatican is saying about their discussions still ahead.
Welcome back to EWTN News In Depth. June 24th marks the anniversary of one of the most consequential decisions in U.S. Supreme Court history, the overturning of Roe v. Wade. In the landmark case known as Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization, Supreme Court justices found that the Constitution does not confer a right to abortion. The authority to regulate abortion was then returned to the states. The historic vote sparked joy from some and outrage from others. Pro-life groups praised the decision as a win for the right to life. Pro-abortionists claimed women's rights were being set back decades. The move to return abortion regulation to state legislatures was quickly received with trigger laws instituting bans on abortion at various stages of gestation or measures to protect abortion access. Currently, 14 states ban most abortions, but include exceptions for either rape and incest or the life of the mother. States in orange have various gestational limits. North Carolina's recently passed 12-week limit will go into effect in July. Judges blocked bans in 8 states, including a 6-week limit in South Carolina that was signed earlier this month. While access to abortion is debated among state Supreme Courts and legislatures, another abortion case is likely headed to the U.S. Supreme Court. The case out of Texas focuses on the abortion pill mifepristone, which is the first of 2 pills used in medical abortions. The Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine, along with 3 other pro-life medical groups, claimed mifepristone was not properly vetted by the Food and Drug Administration and is unsafe. Justice Department lawyers representing the FDA say the drug went through rigorous testing before it was approved more than 20 years ago. After a Texas judge ordered a hold on federal approval of the drug, the case went to the 5th Circuit Court of Appeals in May. We're still awaiting the circuit court's ruling. Let's sort through what's happening on pro-life legislation in the states, with 2 Catholic leaders deep in the trenches working on this issue every day. We're joined by Kathleen Domingo, Executive Director of the California Catholic Conference, and Rick Masacchio, Executive Director of the Tennessee Catholic Conference. They come from 2 states with almost polar opposite stances on life issues. Kathleen and Rick, thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be with you.
Rick, let's start with you very briefly. Give our viewers a quick synopsis of what has happened regarding abortion legislation in Tennessee since the Dobbs decision 1 year ago.
Tennessee was actually pretty well positioned from a policy standpoint when the Dobbs decision dropped. In 2014, the state adopted an amendment to the Constitution that clarified that Tennessee's Constitution was not more expansive on abortion than the U.S. Constitution. And then in 2019, the legislature passed the Human Life Protection Act, mm-hmm. which served as a trigger law that once Roe was overturned, would kick in and put very significant restrictions on abortion in the state.
And what do you mean by significant restrictions?
almost completely eliminated abortion in Tennessee. We have just simply not available. When the trigger law kicked in, it became clear pretty quickly that there were some issues that needed to be addressed through the legislative process. For example, medical professionals operating under the Catholic ethical and religious directives for healthcare could have faced criminal charges for providing appropriate care for mothers facing life-threatening complications to pregnancies. The legislature in this past session this winter made some significant changes to the posture of the law, took away an affirmative defense arrangement that would have had medical professionals facing criminal charges and potentially having to prove themselves innocent based on judgments of prosecutors. And so with the support of pro-life legislators, modified the law, made it very clear what kinds of treatments for ectopic pregnancies, molar pregnancies, and other specific life-threatening complications are not abortions, and did away with the affirmative defense aspect of the law.
A very important clarification. Kathleen, you're in California in a very different scenario. Quickly, tell our audience what has happened legislatively on abortion in your state in the last year.
So unfortunately, the Dobbs decision was not helpful for pro-life folks in California. Last year alone, we had over 20 bills expanding access to abortion in California and over $200 million of taxpayer money allocated to pay for abortion expansion, abortion workforce, and the abortion infrastructure, as well as abortions themselves for women in California and coming to California for abortion.
Now, Kathleen, in this red and blue state divide, obviously you're in enemy territory for this issue. What can be done to advance pro-life causes that is in a place that's so pro-abortion? And Rick, I'm going to come to you for that in a second, but let's start with Kathleen.
Sure. So it's getting harder and harder through the legislative process for us to enact any kind of reasonable pro-life positions. And so what we're really doing right now is we're trying to protect our pro-life pregnancy centers and clinics. They're under attack here in California. We had a couple of bills earlier in the session that died and then got an amend bills. Two came back that are fighting against our pregnancy centers and clinics and that beautiful pro-life witness and access to maternal health and to prenatal care that's so desperately needed. So we need to protect them. And then more and more, we just need to open up that safety net, provide equitable services for pregnant and parenting moms and families in California so they can stay here, have children, and thrive in our state.
That's beautiful. Now, Rick, you're in the opposite situation. What is your advice for how to work in a state that is anti-abortion but also has a lot to contend with?
Well, the Dobbs decision was a reminder for an opportunity for our three bishops who pledged to redouble our efforts to assist, walk with women, family, children in need facing unexpected or problem pregnancy. We have done that through our Catholic charities across the state, through some of our other institutions, and through our parishes. We've had support in the legislature as well. Efforts to bring back abortion to Tennessee have been soundly defeated. And Governor Lee, through some of his other budgetary actions, has dedicated significant funds, I believe about $100 million, to supporting families in caring for their children in the first year of life. One of the Medicaid available benefits now is diapers for low-income families for the first year of life. And of course, sounds like a little thing, but for people facing poverty across the state, that is a significant help.
Oh yeah, it's expensive.
So, you know, we've been very fortunate that we have that kind of support on abortion, on early life issues. And it's also an opportunity for us to advance our teaching, the expression of life issues beyond abortion. We have, of course, issues with death penalty here in Tennessee. And recently we've been the epicenter of some horrific gun violence in the state. So it's an opportunity for us to talk to legislators in a holistic way and express our position, the idea, the reality that our teaching understands life begins at conception and continues until natural death.
Right, expanding beyond the limits that are political into the limits that are really embracing Catholic teaching, including euthanasia, which I know is an issue in California. Well, both of you as executive directors of statewide Catholic conferences, you take a look at this also from the 40,000-foot vantage point. And nationally, what do you need the pro-life advocacy stage, both the organizations and the individuals, and maybe even the Bishops' Conference, to do for you? What would be strategic in helping to get rid of some of the errors that we've made since the Dobbs decision that led to some big disappointments in some states that started with ballot initiatives? What adjustments do you think are necessary? Kathleen, let's start with you.
Sure. For us, really, right now, what we're fighting is late-term abortion in California. We very famously lost our Proposition 1 last year, which we knew would issue in late-term abortion in California, and it absolutely is. There's already a clinic, DuPont Clinic, being built in Los Angeles just now that claims to provide all trimester abortion. We would love at the federal level for there to be some protection. People around the state of California, people around the nation, the vast majority don't want late-term abortion. They understand that that's a line too far, and we could really use that help. I think the second thing is the protection for our pro-life pregnancy centers and clinics. These centers and clinics are licensed. They have licensed professionals working at them. They should not be under attack in these ways from states who are going after them. It really is an equity issue. We're saying if there's true choice, then women who want to continue their pregnancy, women who are looking for help with pregnancy and parenting, should have access, especially in rural areas, especially in the inner city. We're looking at a real reduction in the healthcare workforce. Help at the federal level to protect those pro-life pregnancy centers and clinics would be really essential for us.
Rick, and where would you take this conversation around what you need from the federal government or what the political candidates who are starting to declare themselves on abortion should be drawing their lines around?
Well, you know, one thing, Monsi, I think that's important to note, that Tennessee's law, I think, could be a good example for the rest of the country, that we can clearly spell out ways to provide the health care that mothers truly need, particularly when facing life-threatening challenges and complications to pregnancies. Those, of course, as you all well know, the ERDs, the Catholic Healthcare Directives, provide protocols to care for women who are facing those kind of life-threatening complications with non-viable pregnancies. But to move beyond that, to understand and take this opportunity to fully embrace the breadth of what it means to have a pro-life message, to defend life from beginning until natural end.
For both of you, as you're thinking about the role of state legislatures, you've talked about some of the ways that you could provide direct support for families on the financial margins. What do you think is the role of the federal government in partnering with state legislatures? This will be a wrap up. I'll start with you, Kathleen.
Sure, of course. I think that paid family leave has got to be critical. I think access to affordable, high-quality childcare. I really want to talk about housing. California, of course, has a housing crisis, but other places do too. So just making sure that housing market is available so people can feel comfortable in starting a family and continuing a family and furthering a family. So those social safety net issues are critical for us. We're fighting them here, but we can fight them federally and have that help everyone in the country at the same time.
Absolutely. Rick, where do you draw those lines?
Well, I think those are all very important issues. The notion that's expressed in faithful citizenship, for example, that Catholic social teaching does not line up with either party's views and positions. We've got to get to the middle and support life from beginning until its natural end in all of its stages.
Well, we're grateful to both of you for this conversation, and we'll be looking out for what comes up in the legislative sessions when they open up again. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The battle over abortion continues on the federal level and is likely to be a hot topic at the polls next year. In a recent panel on EWTN Pro-Life Weekly, Marjorie Dannenfelser of Susan B. Anthony Pro-Life America says that pro-life presidential candidates must have a clear stance on a federal limit of abortion.
So the idea that we would not have equal or bigger push on the federal level is not pro-life. And any candidate who says they don't have a job to do on this, many of them having already voted on legislation that would limit abortion, cannot be supported by the pro-life movement. In other words, have a plan for the vision now that we're at the starting line, and make sure that you go and you run that race until it's finished and every single child in this country is protected regardless of where they're conceived.
To see the full panel and for continued coverage of the Dobbs anniversary, tune in to EWTN Pro-Life Weekly on Tuesday at 1:30 p.m. Eastern. You can also find it on EWTN's YouTube page. The week's top headlines are coming up next on EWTN News In Depth, including two women who are one step closer to sainthood. We'll be right back. News about the culmination of the outcry against the Los Angeles Dodgers tops the Week in Review. After weeks of outcry and news coverage of the Los Angeles Dodgers honoring a group that many call anti-Catholic, Pride Night at Dodger Stadium came and went, but not without protest. On Friday, June 16th, Catholics and Christians gathered outside of Dodger Stadium hours before the game was set to start. Carrying signs, singing songs, and praying the rosary, they blasted the Major League Baseball team for honoring an LGBTQ group that openly mocks Jesus and the Catholic sacraments. The so-called Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence are men who describe themselves as queer or trans nuns. Their organization has been involved with service to the gay community for 30 years. Though the group says its members are not anti-Catholic, it is known for grotesque depictions and sexualization of our Savior Jesus Christ, His Passion, Catholic sacraments, and more. The group was supposed to receive its Community Service Award during the game, but the honor was moved to before the game in front of a mostly empty stadium. Originally, the announcement of the invitation sparked condemnation from some lawmakers, including Florida Senator Marco Rubio. That led the Dodgers to disinvite the group, only to invite them back after outcry from the gay community. The United States Conference of Catholic Bishops, alongside the Archdiocese of Los Angeles, asked Catholics to pray the Litany of the Sacred Heart of Jesus last Friday in an act of reparation. L.A. Archbishop Jose Gomez addressed the anti-Catholic group in his Sunday homily.
Catholics share God's love not only in our words and worship. We prove our love through works of charity and mercy for all men and women. This is why so many of us are offended by the decision to honor a group that insults Jesus and mocks Catholic believers.
Several Major League Baseball players also voiced their opposition to the group's invite. We brought you an exclusive interview on that topic with Washington Nationals pitcher Trevor Williams last week. If you would like to watch the full interview, it's available on the EWTN YouTube page. A busy week for the Holy Father in his first full week back at the Vatican following abdominal surgery. On Tuesday, Pope Francis met with the president of Cuba, Miguel Díaz-Canel. The Vatican says the two discussed maintaining diplomatic relations between the Holy See and Cuba and the importance of always promoting the common good. Communist Cuba is known for its complete control over and suppression of religious freedom and has grown to become the least Catholic country in Latin America, though the vast majority of its population is nominally Catholic. Earlier this year, a papal envoy pressed Cuban authorities to release political prisoners who had protested the communist regime. Díaz-Canel is the third Cuban president to visit the Vatican since the Cuban Revolution. Fidel Castro was received by Pope John Paul II in 1996. Pope Francis also met this week with Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. The men have known each other for years and gave each other a warm embrace. Following their meeting, Lula's Vatican talks continued with the Vatican Secretary of State's office. The relationship between the Vatican and Brazil, the fight against poverty and inequality, respect for Brazil's indigenous populations, and the protection of the environment were all discussed. The Vatican is preparing for this October Synod on Synodality, a General Assembly gathering designed to formalize Pope Francis's vision of a more inclusive, decentralized, and listening church. What's known as an instrumentum laboris, or working tool document, was released this week. It outlines many topics of discussion for the assembly, including some controversial ones, such as women deacons, LGBTQ outreach, priestly celibacy, and greater participation in decision-making by the people of God. The Instrumentum Laboris provides a framework for the month-long synod at the Vatican, which will bring together bishops, priests, religious, and laypeople from around the world. Its topics emerged after listening sessions already conducted on the diocesan, national, and continental levels.
The holy people of God is a gift to the world, and it's the Church. So if we really want to listen to the Church, we have to listen to the holy people of God, where the Holy Spirit dwells.
After this fall synod, there will be 1 year of spiritual discernment as recommendations are considered before a second session 1 year later in 2024. The advisory final document from that synod will be presented to Pope Francis, who can either adopt its text as a papal document or write his own conclusion. For more details of what is in the Instrumentum Laboris, see full coverage in our sister publication, the National Catholic Register. Two devout Catholic women who also happen to be religious sisters are one step closer to sainthood. Pope Francis advanced Mother Mary Elizabeth Lang's cause for Servant of God to Venerable on Thursday. Lang founded America's first African-American religious congregation in Baltimore in 1829, named the Oblate Sisters of Providence. She also established a school in her own home and with her own money for the children of her fellow black immigrants. The church will now need to approve a miracle attributed to her intercession before she can be beatified. And famed Sister Lucia dos Santos, the eldest child to witness the apparitions at Fatima, has also reached venerable status. She's the only Fatima visionary who spoke with the Virgin Mary. The two other visionaries, Jacinta and Francisco Marto, were canonized in 2017. Sister Lucia spent the final 50 years of her life in a Carmelite convent in Portugal. Her canonization cause opened 3 years after her death in 2008.
I always knew that it's the most important thing I should do is be a good Catholic. I always knew that. I always believed that.
Sharing the fruits of his labor to honor God, Thomas Monahan, the founder of Ave Maria University, explains how his Catholic faith helped shape his actions. Grabbing a quick bite at a fast food restaurant may not have you thinking about Catholicism. But one chain, Domino's Pizza, was founded by a Catholic entrepreneur, Thomas Monahan. By secular standards, he had everything a man could want, with his vast wealth enabling a lavish lifestyle. But the entrepreneur says his greatest achievements have come by devoting himself to Catholic philanthropy. Reporter Colin Flynn sat down with him for this week's Faith Journey in Depth.
This is an amazing story about pizza, but not just any pizza, Domino's Pizza. But it's not a story about how it is the largest pizza chain in the world with 20,000 stores worth $18 billion. No, this is a story of how it all started. After one small boy who grew up in an orphanage and came from nothing, wanted to work hard and do something with his life. Now, in a rare interview, he tells his story of how he built a billion-dollar pizza empire and why he left it all to pursue something deeper in life. I'm Colm Flynn, and I've come to Naples in Florida to meet the founder of Domino's Pizza, Thomas Monahan. Thomas Monahan had a rough start in life. He was born in Ann Arbor in Michigan and was only 4 years old when his father passed away at Christmas.
But he died on Christmas Eve, and when I was four.
Christmas Eve?
Almost five.
Wow. Do you remember that?
Well, I remember at the funeral home, they were keeping me out of there, but we happened to be walking through, and I saw the casket with him, and I went up to it, and I there he was in the Sudan, and I said, wake up, Daddy, wake up, Daddy, and they pulled me out of there. Mm. That was really heart-wrenching.
His mother wasn't able to cope after her husband's death, and a young Thomas and his brother were put into an orphanage, St. Joseph's Home for Boys.
So when you were in the orphanage then for 6 years, you're wondering, why did my father have to die? Were you angry as well that you were in an orphanage? Were you thinking, why is this?
Well, I might be like other kids. And the orphanage was, basically it was like a prison. It was 50 boys, Polish nuns, very strict, very holy.
Life in the orphanage was tough. It was strict with plenty of work to do. And one of Thomas's jobs every day was to clean the small chapel, which brought him close to the Blessed Sacrament.
I had the honor the last couple of years I was there to clean the chapel. Everybody had a different part of the structure, and I had the chapel. And so I spent a lot of time before the Blessed Sacrament.
And was it something about the Blessed Sacrament when you were in there?
I felt I was in a special place, and I of course knew that Jesus in that tabernacle up there.
And even though he would sometimes get upset in the orphanage, he never despaired, and instead he focused on what he could do after he left.
Just wait till I'm on my own. You know, I just looking ahead. I was going to do all the things I'm capable of doing and want to do and should do when I'm 18 years old and I'm on my own.
After leaving the orphanage, Thomas spent some time in the U.S. Marines. And then after that, he was a little bit lost in life, looking for a job and for a purpose. It was then that his brother suggested he borrow a couple of $100 to buy an old pizzeria that was for sale in Ann Arbor in Michigan.
It was called Dominic's.
Dominic's Pizzeria.
Yeah. And it was a hole in the wall. It was $500 down, but became the largest pizza chain in the world.
It's incredible, isn't it?
He changed the name from Dominic's to Domino's and then opened two other pizzerias in Michigan, each store represented by a dot on the Domino's logo, still there today. He had a sharp mind, and over the next two decades, he redesigned the pizza box to keep the pizzas hotter for longer. He insisted they only focus on takeaway and delivery, no more dining in. He designed the conveyor belt pizza oven to cook the pizzas faster. And he guaranteed a hot pizza in 30 minutes or your money back. A stroke of marketing genius. That's when Domino's and Thomas's life started to change forever.
And finally, after 20 years, I got everything worked out. And I started in 1960, this was 1980. And we took off like a rocket. We were the fastest growing restaurant chain in the history of the world. In 1985, we opened 954 stores, more than anybody ever did.
In 1 year?
1 year.
950.
Actually, in a 12-month period, we did over 1,000.
Wow.
In the calendar year.
900, and that's like three stores a day are opening.
That's
up.
That's right.
Three stores a day.
And the beginning, in 1980, we had about 300 stores. About 1986 or 7, we had 5,000.
Thomas Monahan, the once orphan, went from having three stores to hundreds, to thousands, to tens of thousands all over the world.
But you know the funny thing about that name, Domino's? You know what it means in Latin?
No.
The Lord.
Thomas was still praying to the Lord, but was distracted. His enormous success had brought enormous wealth.
Some say he's worth at least $300 million, rich enough to buy almost anything he wants, including his hometown baseball team.
As the business became phenomenally successful, it made you a phenomenally wealthy man as well. How did that change your life?
Yeah, they listed me in Forbes and Fortune as a billionaire. And I think I don't know if I was 50 yet or not, maybe.
How does that change you as a person, going from growing up in an orphanage and then being a billionaire?
I wasn't as ready for it as I thought I was. I was going to Mass every day, practicing my faith, reading a lot of spiritual books. And I thought, I can handle it. I can handle it. But I got into the toys. I justified the yachts, the airplanes.
I remember reading a quote from you once, Tom, where you said, my life had become a high-speed train going down the tracks, but was about to become a train wreck.
That was true.
It was after reading C.S. Lewis one night that Thomas realized that he was chasing material possessions to try and prove to others that he was successful in life.
C.S. Lewis said the reason you aim so high and want so much, it's not what you want, it's what you want is more than other people. Sell more pieces than anybody else and have more money than anybody. And I thought, that's not what I want to be.
You want me to do that?
Thinking of his legacy and wanting to give back, in 1998, Thomas Monaghan sold Domino's Pizza for a reported $1 billion. And with that money, he did something extraordinary. He built not just a university, but a church and an entire town called Ave Maria, where young Catholics could study, live their faith with their families and growing community.
So I wanted to be a beacon for Catholic higher education. Show that orthodoxy sells.
Today, there are around 33,000 people living in Ave Maria town, with its own neighborhoods, bars, restaurants, and parks. The church Thomas built is at the center of the campus and the square, with a sculpture of the Archangel Gabriel over the door. The university has over 1,200 students who study a range of subjects like economics, biochemistry, business, nursing, politics, physics, theology, and so on. And at 86 years of age, Thomas Monaghan is still focusing on what matters to him most in life.
What is your dream and hope for this place?
I want every student to come out being a well-formed Catholic, well-educated. I want to teach courses that the church needs the most.
Your faith today, Tom, how is your faith today?
I'm working on it.
Still a work in progress?
Yeah, I think I got to make it up to do. During those go-go years, as I call it, I wasted a lot of God's money. When I get to the pearly gate, and God's been very good to me, I want to be able to say I used what he gave me well.
Thomas Monaghan, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
In Ave Maria Town, Florida, Colm Flynn, EWTN News in Depth.
This year, the Solemnity of the Most Sacred Heart of Jesus fell on June 16th. The feast day is promoted thanks to Sister Margaret Mary Alacoque, a French nun who received visions from Jesus on ways to venerate his Sacred Heart. Over time, the feast has grown into a month of devotion that Catholics around the world honor. We take you to where it all started in Eastern France for our Images of the Week.
Here in Paray-le-Monial, it's 3 days of celebration. Today, there is a celebration of the Mass. And in the afternoon, there is a procession of the Blessed Sacrament. There is three important place here in Paray-le-Monial, the Basilica, the Chapel of the Apparition with the Sister of the Visitation, and the Chapel of Claude La Colombière, the Jesuit, who authenticate the apparition of the Sacred Heart to Marguerite Mary.
What a beautiful way to celebrate our Savior, Jesus Christ. We hope you're inspired to devote your prayer time to the Sacred Heart of Jesus. And that does it for our broadcast this week. Next week, EWTN News in Depth will be taking a little break, but we'll return on July 7th with more stories important to your Catholic faith. See you then.